Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host and founder of Product Innovation Educators, where product managers learn to be product masters. I'm bringing back an incredible guest who I first interviewed way back in episode 10, one of the first interviews I actually did. He wrote the step-by-step guide for implementing lean startup practices titled Running Lean. He also created the Lean Canvas tool, and he blogs regularly, recently daily, about these topics at leanstack.com. His name is Ash Maria, and now he has a new book about applying lean startup principles to go from new product concept to a product that is achieving predictable success with customers. The book is titled Scaling Lean, Mastering the Key Metrics for Startup Growth. And while it is written in the context of startup growth, the concepts apply to any product management effort that involves creating a new product or improving an existing one, from startups to large enterprises. In the interview, you're going to learn three aspects of what it means to scale lean: using metrics, prioritizing waste, and practices to achieve success. To get the notes of the discussion, the summary, as well as the transcript, go to theeverydayinnovator.com/077. Enjoy the discussion. Ash, thanks for joining the Everyday Innovator again. This is your second appearance on the podcast, and corresponds with your second book that I'm very much looking forward to getting into further myself.
It's a pleasure, Chad. Thanks for having me again.
Let's provide some context here. So now, your first book was Running Lean, Iterate from Plan A to a Plan That Works. And this is the first book that kind of follows the Eric Ries Lean Startup Series from O'Reilly Publishing. And I think of it, you know, from a product management perspective, because I know it applies to creating any product, not just in a startup context. And product managers can really use that to create and execute a plan for achieving that product market fit that we talk about. And since you wrote that book, now you have written Scaling Lean. What have you discovered since, in between the time?
Sure. Yeah. And I actually, looking back, wish there wasn't as much time, but sometimes it takes us long to both find problems we're tackling and then going and actually writing a whole book to help solve them. But very much like my last book, that last book came out of me struggling with the starting stages of a startup, of a product. How do you go and deal with some of those uncertainties? And a lot of it was very much based in first-hand experiential learning, and that's how Running Lean came about. Since it came out, I continued writing, I continued speaking, and then even went into teaching workshops and things like that. And in there were a number of questions that repeatedly surfaced. Many of them were about what comes next. So as we have learned from the Lean Startup and Running Lean, we know how to start with lean canvases, how to describe a business model. We know how to go and build the minimum viable product. But as that gets out there, as the team begins to grow, how do we practice lean as a, both as a methodology, as a process? Because as we know, as we add people, things start getting challenging. On the other side, which was a bit counterintuitive, but as we start adding customers too, we actually start getting pulled in many different directions. So those were some of the questions I began to hear. And I started my own process of looking for answers. And then that's how the second book came about.
Okay. And who do you think this book is really targeted for? Like I mentioned, I know the original thinking is kind of the startup context, but you also get brought into large enterprises to help them on their processes. And not surprising, I put kind of everything in that product management context that we're developing a product.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of this is influenced heavily by the Lean Startup, and that has the word startup in it. But as everyone in that space has found out, is that startup is more kind of a metaphor for starting a new project. And I'll even use the word project and not even product, because it could even be an existing product line where you are forking off and trying to find new markets or even new releases or new opportunities there.
Sure, absolutely.
And that's the message, is that we have seen a lot of this thinking and a lot of these methodologies or methods being applied in both large and small companies.
And I would expect the scaling perspective ties into that very well. And I use new product always in the sense of it could be a new to the world sort of product, radical innovation. Or it could just be a new iteration, the next series, the next evolution, you know, like the iPhone 7 after the iPhone 6, right?
Exactly.
And in that context, that fits really well inside large companies that are typically doing the more incremental, you know, innovation.
Yes.
So I want to walk through kind of the big principles of scaling lean. And I think it would be helpful to anchor those to an example. And I know in the book you talk through several examples. Can you just share some of those examples and give us a context for one that we can kind of use to anchor the practices around?
Sure. So as you said, scaling lean definitely is reaching, if I kind of put some timelines, running lean really talked about how do you start, get to what I call problem solution fit, and maybe build out your first iteration. Scaling lean takes you all the way to scale and sometimes beyond. So many of the examples in the book, I draw from case studies, you know, retrospectively in some cases, looking at companies like Facebook, Tesla, Airbnb, Dropbox, HubSpot, and we can go back in time and see them. You know, at the time, they may not be saying we're doing lean, but the principles are in there. They're embedded in what they did. So we can take those patterns out. So I do that to illustrate a lot of these concepts, which we might get into. But I always feel that it's a lot more tangible and, for me, a lot more practical to speak from firsthand experience. So in the book, I use a product that I build using a lot of the techniques in the book. So a little recursive there, or meta-recursive. But the product that I built was an analytics product. Again, the domain is irrelevant. The point of that kind of story there is that going back in time, I had built a homegrown system. I began socializing it with a handful of, in this case, software developers, software founders. They really liked what I built. There was nothing else on the market. They told me, if you build this, I will buy. In my previous life, I would be jumping up and down because I validated my market.
Right.
But having done this far too many times and realizing that a sample size of 3 is not anywhere near market validation, I went through this process very rigorously. So that's the example we'll use here. And I'll kind of bake in kind of some of your questions using that as the backdrop of where I started.
Yeah, very good. And unfortunately, people are getting involved in, you know, we have that new idea that we want to go put into practice, and we ask our mom and our two best friends. And if that's our sample size, it might just be misleading. And I'm sure, just like you, I get the phone calls every now and then, people that I'm glad to try to help, that they've already gotten into product development. They have a product ready to go out to talk to people about, and they've done nothing yet for validation to get
that's
there.
Right.
So it's a little bit late at that point. So one of the, when I looked at your book, there's kind of three big categories. And one of them was talking about metrics and useful metrics for kind of reaching that product market fit. What are the metrics for scaling lean? And tie that into the example that you're going to walk us through, that user cycle.
Yeah. So with the user cycle, by this point, I had written running lean. And so I was applying all of those principles already. So I had a lean canvas. And for those of you in the audience that may not know what that is, that's essentially a one-page business plan. It allows you to go out, and instead of writing 60 pages of fiction, you can write a one-page fictional document, because it's going to change a lot. But the point is that it saves you time. More importantly, it gets you talking about that business model story. Now, what I learned is that we can tell very effective stories. And so I was able to tell the story of user cycle to myself. I told it to my team, and they thought it was great. They thought we should go do it. Mm-hmm. And then only when we started working on it did we realize that maybe there are some aspects of it that weren't there, and that ties into your metrics question. So in the business plan, there's both the business model story, but then there's also the forecasting section where we do the Excel magic wizardry. And I kind of joke because we go too far there, like we do with the business plan, and we start working with thousands of numbers when we don't really need to. So I was looking for a better way to estimate whether a business model is worth pursuing in the first place, beyond the story, because everyone I talked to, they said, this sounds compelling. Yes, you should go validate it.
Right.
But when I came back, I found that, you know, maybe this is still not going to be a big enough opportunity. So some of the metrics that I come up with, they all have, or I talk about in scaling lean, they all have to be measures of customer behavior. We can't measure anything else. So we can't measure how much code you've written or how big your team is, or, you know, any other proxy of it. It has to be built on customer adoption, customer learning. So the metrics that I kind of dive into in the book is what I call the customer factory blueprint, heavily influenced by Dave McClure's pirate metrics. Some of you might be aware of that in the audience. These are the acquisition steps, the activation step, referral revenue, and retention. So those are the five kind of anchors of macro metrics that make sense. But the more important thing is that with these five basic metrics, and sometimes even fewer than these five, you can estimate a business model. If I begin to start asking myself, what is the price point for my particular product? What is my goal? You know, what revenue run rate or how many customers do I need to get? Mm-hmm. We can begin to size using some estimation techniques. And I'm a big fan of Fermi, who was a physicist, but some Fermi estimation techniques. We can ballpark a business model, and not so much for validation, but oftentimes for invalidation. So when I came back and ran this 5-minute back of the envelope exercise with the user cycle product, I realized that $50 a month, which is what we were going to charge, was just not going to cut it. We would not be able to validate this, or we would not be able to build this business model in the best case scenario. So if we got everyone we thought we would get using our product and everything was going well, it would not meet the business model goal. And that was very eye-opening. So I had an immediate invalidation with that exercise.
So key things there, metrics are focused on actual customer behavior. So as we were talking about before, it's not what your friends or ideally what fresh people you're talking about the idea are just giving you feedback on. You know, so one customer behavior I've focused on is we sometimes will ask people, you know, would you buy this product if we make it and it does these things, right? And a lot of people say, yeah, that meets my need. And then you ask, well, it's going to be $60 a month. And could you write a check now for the first month? Well, I don't know if I would really buy. You know, people start hemming and hawing a little bit about that. So actual customer behavior, great focus. And then you said this was a 5-minute exercise for you to actually figure out for user cycle, right? So this isn't a complicated process to actually do the quick math and say, okay, do we have a viable business model here or not?
Yeah, and it's pretty amazing because it's a bottoms up versus top down approach. So the top down approach is I'm going after a big market. It's a $1 billion market. Now I'm not greedy. I only want 0.001%, and that's all I need. So that should be doable. And every entrepreneur, you know, walked around with that reality distortion field. Mm-hmm. The problem is that when we look at it bottoms up, tell me who that customer is, how will you reach them, what will they pay for your product? I was talking to one entrepreneur and she said, well, I don't even think I would buy my product. You know, I don't think it should be, you know, it should be for anything. I'm like, how do you make money? And then she had to really think about it. Mm. So it's amazing how we just think I'm going into this big space, so there's money there. But you have to start thinking about who your customer is, mm-hmm. and then bottoms up, build that up. And that's a very different story.
It is. And having that very clear image, preferably by name and individuals that you would think about that yeah. would buy this, all the better. And focus on customer behavior. Good point on metrics. So another big section of the book was addressing waste, right? And this kind of comes out of the traditional lean thinking of, you know, that might have started with Toyota and how do we reduce waste from our processes. And you talk about in the context of achieving success with the product. So what aspects of waste are important to recognize?
Yeah, and maybe just throwing out a definition. So this is from Womack's book, Lean Thinking. Mm-hmm. I think there are two authors, but that's the one I remember. But the definition of waste is any human activity that consumes resources but doesn't add value. And again, that value in there, it's not explicitly stated, but it's customer value. So if we kind of use that as a backdrop, we have to be looking at everything we're building, our product, our marketing, our sales, and trying to be efficient, trying to remove inefficiencies, not doing needless busy work. That's right. Essentially what that waste is. Now, in Toyota, and Taichi Ono, the father of the Toyota production system, mm-hmm. is famous for drawing these chalk circles. They would draw a chalk circle and have a manager stand in there for a whole shift looking for waste. And it was very hard to find waste because they were already very efficient. Sometimes several hours would go by and it'd feel like it's punishment, but it was really a training exercise. Mm-hmm. And sometimes just bringing in a piece of machinery from 5 feet to 20 feet away or vice versa can have a big impact on the workflow and the movement of work throughout the factory. So those are the kind of things they were doing. Now, when we bring this to early stage products, I find that our challenge isn't so much finding waste, but really prioritizing waste. Hmm. So anyone who's starting with a new product, whether you're a product manager, you're a developer, whether you're an entrepreneur, you wake up every day and you probably have hundreds, if not thousands of things you can potentially improve. So when I take that waste question, I'm always looking for what are the right waste activities to go after? So what should we prioritize? And a lot of it is trying to find that single domino that will allow us to move the business model forward versus just, again, getting busy with needless busy work. So in that user cycle example, and some of the early starting stages are pretty obvious. The waste is very obvious. We have to go and, everything we talked about, we have to go and test for customer demand by measuring what customers will do. Because if you get the customers wrong, the problems you're going to be solving are going to be wrong. The channels, the pricing, everything falls apart. So getting the customer and the problem right, which is what I call in the first book, problem solution fit, is absolutely critical. And the way that we can do this is counterintuitively, we can do this without even building a product. So you can go out there and just like in your story, you can say, here's what I'm going to go build. Show them a demo if you need to. Let them be able to visualize the product. Tell them it's going to cost this much. And that's where you get closer to them really getting to making an action, a buy decision. And then you measure whether they move forward, whether it's giving you a credit card or giving you money, or even just getting up on your signup list. You have to buffer that, of course. But the point is that you want to measure that in the beginning. So that's an example of what you should do. There's no point trying to optimize your code, trying to build a website, trying to do anything else until you can get what I sometimes just say, get 10 people to say they'll buy your product and prove it. So get them to, you know, do something that's measurable. And then you have permission to go and build a website, start building the product, doing all those other types of things.
And in doing that activity of removing the waste, you talked about the dominoes that line up. And I think that's a good way to think about it, because sometimes we look at what's going on in that user experience and the feature set of the products we're considering as kind of individual pieces that don't necessarily relate. But if we look at it maybe from not our perspective as the developers, but from the customer's experience and what really is important to them, we might find one domino that we, if we take that out, we immediately realize, oh, there's three or four others that we are creating waste to that relate to that.
Yeah. And that's a key point and one that I try to draw home. And unfortunately, you know, I know why this happened, but work has been specialized and we have distanced ourselves from the customers. So if you look at any large company, it usually started with the founding team. And usually that founding team knew the customer intimately. So they were talking to the customer usually every day. Mm-hmm. But as the company grew, systems and processes got into play where we create these internal KPIs. So we say, you developers, you know, I'm going to use software as an example, you know, your job is to build stuff and we'll tell you what to build. And so we trust that whoever's figuring that out is telling them the right things to build. And we just want to measure you based on your build velocity.
Right.
But what we're finding out is that in those handoffs, lots of things get thrown on the floor. Sometimes things get outdated. What we learned 3 months ago is no longer the case because we're living in this massive pace of disruption, innovation. So the customer behaviors you may have learned 3 months ago, by the time developers get it, by the time it goes through your quality assurance cycles, it's already obsolete.
Right.
And so we need to build a more real-time continuous feedback loop. And that's why in the book, I challenge all the departments to really tie their KPIs to longer-term customer behavior metrics. Because if a developer is building a whole, you know, 10 features and those features never get used, that's a perfect example of waste.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's the developer's job, just like it is the product, you know, manager's job and other people, customer service, to make sure that feature is being used by ensuring that we are putting in the right metrics, we are doing the right usability testing, we are interfacing with customers, making sure we're building the right products. So all of those things I kind of challenge in, because if you just focus in on those proxy metrics, we sometimes don't see that bigger picture.
And this makes me think a little bit just about the title of the book, Scaling. Because there's different connotations of scaling here, right?
Yes.
And they all kind of fit in the sense that one way I think about is just when I hear the title itself, not knowing all the details, is, oh, this is how larger companies can bring in, you know, lean startup kind of practices, right? That they scale to their organization, which certainly does apply. But we also, when it comes to waste, we have this issue of scaling, if it's a technology product, maybe scaling the architecture, scaling the production system for physical products, scaling for what we expect to happen based on some maybe early forecast, right? That was part of that business plan.
Yes.
And that is a ripe area for waste also when we're not ready for that yet, right?
Yes.
And you talk about scaling really in terms of traction and customer behavior leading to more customer adoption.
Yes. And that was kind of an intentional play. I mean, obviously, because the first book was Running Lean, you know, the third kind of reason, at least for being an author, is that it seems like a natural sequel to the book. So that's another, that was a third reason to throw in there. But it definitely is, in my mind, it was meant to be more a maturity of the practice of the lean process. Mm-hmm. Because again, I find that in the earlier stages, founding teams come together and they can do all this stuff fairly qualitatively. It's a small, you know, group of 3 to 5 people. But as you get 30 people in the room, you need systems and processes. So the book goes a lot into concepts like lean sprints, and there's more process stuff, which, you know, we can or we don't have to get into, but it goes into how do you practice this kind of thinking at scale. But going to your other question is that it also talks about how do you scale your traction or your product in steps. So I find that sometimes where I think you were going is that too many startups or too many teams get into this premature scaling trap.
Right.
So they try to premature.
By that, I mean scaling the architecture, right?
So this might be, you know, we need to support 1 million users because that's
exactly,
you know, where this is going to get to. Well, today you only have 100 users and there's going to be quite some time before you get to 1 million. So you don't have to worry about that. So that's the premature scaling. But we will say, you know, we need to look out for the future. We'll put our development, we'll put some people on that. And I find that that again creates waste mm-hmm. because we don't necessarily even know that this code will get to that scale. So why even optimize it to that extent? So instead, what I'm an advocate for is use your metrics to figure out where are the biggest constraints, what are those single dominoes that are holding you back. It may not be an architectural issue, it may be a marketing issue.
Right.
So in that case, let's put all of our eggs in that basket and overcome that bottleneck. And once that becomes a scaling issue on the product side, then put resources to it. And we always feel that, oh my God, you know, there won't be time to do all of that stuff. But you can see time and time again, companies that grow from, you know, zero to millions and billions, like Facebook and others, have been able to step up. And the fact that you're generating so much value gives you that ability to take the time to scale up. And most products today don't have as much technical risk. So we can usually scale the technical side more easily, even sometimes just by throwing money. You can throw hardware at certain problems. But the other problems, which are more the customer market risk, you can throw as much hardware or money at it, and you may not be able to overcome that one.
Yeah, if you don't start out with the right idea and getting the customers to take the right actions originally, it doesn't matter how you scale the architecture.
Yeah.
And this is, you also talked earlier about the rapid learning that's going on, you know, these iterations, that what we learned maybe 3 months ago about the customer doesn't apply today. And that could be the customer's changing, the market's changing, and very likely what we learned was a little bit off, and we have refined that as we come. And for people that kind of have a traditional perspective on project management, that's different, right? That we traditionally like setting up projects where we know what all the requirements are up front, we're going to execute on those, and we're going to turn out the system on the end, and likely only find out that the system doesn't really meet the needs of the users when we do that.
Yeah,
and this approach is really more the agile approach of let's learn rapidly, you know, fail fast, learn from those experiences, and turn those into a better customer experience and a better product.
Yes. So so again, not all, you know, is I don't want to be all kind of down on the current way of doing things. I do want to say that even in the traditional release cycle, if one were just to reduce those batch sizes, mm-hmm. so rather Absolutely. Than doing a 6-month release cycle, if you did a 3-month release cycle, you know, ideally you would get to what I'm a big fan of is continuous deployment. You would just push features out as they become ready, which is kind of the other extreme. But even if you were to work your way down by just reducing that batch size, that's progress. If you were to just inject, if you were to make it everyone's job to inject some customer learning in the development process, and I threw out the example of usability tests or even metrics, you know, if every developer instrumented their features so that they could measure whether it was being used or not, that's progress, right? So being able to come back even 3 months later and saying, you know, we pushed this stuff out last release, but no one's using it. We probably should take it out because it's just, you know, it's just taking up technical debt in the system.
Right.
So all of those types of things are ways to get yourself up to, you know, what we'd like to talk about is going as fast as you can learn, but you don't have to get there overnight.
And that's another good example of waste, of having features and capabilities in the product that just simply aren't being used.
Yeah.
And occasionally we see, you know, Apple is pretty good at this. And I remember one change to, I think it was the iMovie Maker, that they actually took out some features that I was using at the time. But I understand why they did it. And it does reduce, as you said, that technical debt. You know, the more features we have in products that don't get used, the more we deal with every time we have a revision change.
Right.
So the third section of the book covers lots of practices for what you talk about in terms of achieving breakthrough success. And we probably don't have time to dive into all of them. So pull out the kind of the key ones that you see making the biggest difference.
Yeah, I think the biggest one is this pattern I saw. So if you look at most progress, most big breakthroughs, just by definition, come by accident. Mm-hmm. You know, very few people had a master plan. We can look at this in scientific discoveries, in entrepreneurial discoveries, where people, they go down a certain path, something unusual happens, and then they uncover this breakthrough insight. Now, the one thing that they repeatedly do is that they don't dismiss what just happened that was unexpected. They actually ask the question, why? That's how penicillin got discovered. There was this weird stuff growing in a petri dish, and the scientists didn't just go, oh, this is all crap, my experiment is ruined. He rather explored further. And I find that too many people run away from that, because unexpected outcomes, the other word for it is failure. So people, the moment they see a sign of, oh, this was not what I expected to happen, they start hiding it. And I find, again, very counterintuitive, but by digging in deeper, that's where you're going to uncover why that thing happened. And sometimes that leads to the insight, which allows you to, in lean startup terminology, pivot towards something that actually does work. So I feel that if anything, that's the most important skill to put out there. The book does go into this notion of how, you know, if you give people a particular problem, there's no shortage of ideas for how we solve them. And oftentimes those ideas come from the biases that people already have, and sometimes the specialization they already have. So if I give you a problem with conversion, you being a designer will say it's a design problem, let's improve UX. You being a developer will want to maybe build a few more features because people will have something more to do, they'll buy them. The marketer will say, no, let's just buy more ads. You know, so those are just simple examples.
Sure.
And again, nothing wrong with any of those solutions because they may be all right. But as the team, you need to figure out which ones do you test and how do you then test from there. So what the book goes into this idea of the lean sprint, which is create a big diversity of ideas. So first agree where the problems lie. So we talked about those single dominoes. Figure out where we should all as a team focus our attention. We need to improve this one metric, for instance, as an example. And then let the teams kind of go away for a little while and then come back with possible solutions. And then that's where lean is very good. Lean startup methodology is very good in taking big ideas like, you know, let's go buy ads or let's go build this feature, and turn them into small, fast experiments. So if we turn them into small, fast experiments, you begin to get incremental feedback on whether this actually can get us out of the hole or not. And if it doesn't, it's very simple. We don't need to pursue this any further. Let's take the next idea in the backlog. But if it does, then let's double down on this one and take it further. So that to me is the essence. And so when we see problems, the most important thing is ask why. If we can get to the whys, we sometimes have to devise some of these incremental experiments to allow us to test our hypotheses for why these things are happening, mm-hmm. and only double down on the ones where we see those leading signals of things now moving in the right direction.
Right. And so we're designing experiments to actually get data so we can take logical action instead of just hoping for the best. When you were doing the user cycle work, is there an example there that this came up of, you know, that unexpected outcome and asking why?
Oh yeah, lots of them. So, I mean, the first one was when we did the modeling, one of the things we learned is that our price point was too low. Mm-hmm. And so we actually had to quadruple the price point from $50 a month to $200 a month to make the model work. On paper, very simple exercise. You don't even need a calculator to do that. Once we went outside the building and started talking to people, they thought we were crazy because they don't buy, at least our customer segment did not buy products at that price point. So they thought it was too expensive. They thought, you know, they could get things for free even that could do similar things. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of those unexpected outcomes. Now, rather than just saying, oh, this will never work, we really try to dig into why that was. And we found out that we were often talking to people that were too early. So they would be actually better off using the free products. But once they hit a certain point, if we could articulate a value proposition based on where they would be at that point, that would make all the sense. So it would make sense to invest the $200 because they would make more in just the 1 month of usage of that product. So it was basically we had to dig into customer segmentation, figure out who was ready for this product, who wasn't. Those that were ready, even they had reservations. So we had to figure out how do we really anchor the value proposition against something they were already buying, money they were already spending. in this case, we realized that a lot of people were thinking that they weren't spending any money because they were spending 20 hours a week building their own dashboards, building their own homegrown systems. But once we brought that up to them, that they are spending core time, if you even put a modest billable rate of, say, $50 an hour, that essentially throws the $200 kind of a month price point out the water because they're spending a lot more money on something that's non-core to them. And so those are some of the things we began to explore into, like, why weren't people buying? And once we understood why weren't they buying, we then came up with some new hypotheses, new ideas for how we can message, how we can price, how we can position. And we got them to shift away from saying, we don't want this product, to, yes, we will at least do a trial with you. Because if you can deliver value, we can see the ROI. And then, of course, all the usual things of risk reversal. We promise them their money back if it didn't work, things you have to do, or give them a trial or a pilot. But the point is that in the beginning, they went from completely, no, you're crazy, this is just too expensive, to saying, yes, we will try your product because based on what you've showed us, this seems very compelling. And if it works, this would be awesome. So that's where we got them to eventually.
Very good. Yeah. Yeah. Good description of the example and the importance there of demonstrating the return on investment from the user's perspective. Yep. And removing the risk. Very good. Well, I appreciate you walking through kind of those three big areas. As the time we're doing this recording, the book's not out yet, but for everyone listening, it should be available on Amazon. And
it is available for pre-order. So.
Okay, awesome.
So please do. And of course, pre-order, as you know, you don't get charged till the book ships. The official publication date is June 14th. We do have an advanced copy promotion that we're doing. We don't have a lot of copies left. So if anyone is dying to get it before June, you can head over to scalinglean.com, and we have still some advanced copies that we are able to distribute by permission from the publisher.
Very good. Appreciate you talking through it, and really look forward to everyone getting their hands on it. And I just want to underscore that. So Everyday Innovators, I know we have people in the audience that are across the spectrum from brand new or even interested in getting into product management all the way to executives of organizations. And these concepts that were in running lean and now have been extended in scaling lean are very applicable to anyone involved in product management and creating products. And I encourage you getting the book and putting it into practice. I always ask our guests for a innovation quote. And Ash, what did you bring for us this time?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit different than the one last time, but I think still in the same spirit. So this is one that I coined kind of recently, and I think it embodies the spirit of the work that I try to do and try to instill in others. And the quote is, love the problem, not the solution. Mm-hmm. So I find that when I find too many makers, product managers, kind of falling in love with the solution, and if we think about it, that's almost like designing a key, but you don't quite know what door that's going to open. But we build this key, and then we start looking for doors or problems to go solve, and that's backwards. It's just the wrong place to be. So I find that if you can instead immerse yourself around a big problem that's kind of something hopefully you're passionate about, or something your business is, you know, that might be your line of business, and you immerse yourself with those customers, expose those problems, the solutions kind of magically become obvious. And now we're actually building keys to doors that open and take us places. So that to me is why I like that quote so much, and the one I'll leave with you today.
That's a great quote. Love the problem, not the solution. And I like the word picture there of the key and the door. So we need to find the right doors to go through. Ash, again, appreciate your time. Thank you for your work on this book, and thank you for telling the listeners about it.
Thank you, Chad. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening and sharing this podcast with other product managers and innovators. As I've said before, together we are making a difference and improving the skills of product managers one listener at a time. And I really appreciate you telling others about this. You'll find the notes from this discussion with Ash, along with the full transcript, at theeverydayinnovator.com/077. Please check it out. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.